Oh, and of course, the other side of it is that they and we knew that if they didn't accept these deals, the people we call jackals would go in. And these are usually retired CIA assets or special forces guys who will overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders.
John Perkins, the economic hitman, how are you, my friend?
Good. It's good to be with you, Andy.
Well, the honor is all mine. As I was mentioning very briefly off camera, I find your story extremely compelling, is I think the right word, or fascinating. I would really like to start with the top. I first heard of you and watched an interview you did with on the Patrick Bet David podcast. I think it was a couple of years ago. And I picked up your book and just became familiar with you. But yeah, I just, enough of that. I just really want to start at the top. How did you get involved in start becoming the economic hitman?
Well, let's see, what part of the story should I start with? So I was originally, when I was about to graduate from business school and be drafted, I didn't believe in the Vietnam War. And was looking for some way out, and I was married to a woman whose father was the best friends with a guy who was very high up in the National Security Agency, the NSA. And that was a potentially draft deferrable job. And so he arranged for me to go through a series of interviews, lie detector tests in Boston. And to my surprise, I passed and was invited to become, you know, to join the NSA basically as a trainee. But very soon after that, I was still in business school, and I walked by a room where a Peace Corps recruiter was talking, and I became fascinated. I always wanted to go to the Amazon, live with indigenous people. I'd been a great fan and student of indigenous people. I grew up in the woods of New Hampshire, and my family goes back to the time when they were very connected with the Algonquin-speaking people. And so after the guy finished talking, I went up to him. I said, hey, you know, if I applied for the Peace Corps and asked for the Amazon, do you think I'd get it? And he says, well, yeah, like nobody wants to go there, so I'm pretty sure I would. So I go back to my friend who at the National Security Agency, and I told him what had happened. And he said, by all means, go in, and I'll make sure, I'll help you make sure you get to the Amazon, because you'll learn really good survival techniques. You'll learn another language or two, and you'll learn, about cultural interchange, and you'll be much more valuable to us than when you get out. But realize that when you get out, you may not work directly for us, the National Security Agency. You may actually work for a private corporation that's affiliated with us. We do a lot of that kind of stuff. And you're an economist, and so there's a good possibility that will happen. And I went in the Peace Corps for 3 years. I was in Ecuador, including that, of course, most of that time in the Amazon living with the Shuar people, indigenous tribe. And while I was there, the last year I was there, I got visited by a vice president from the company I ended up working for, a big consulting firm that had close ties with CIA and the National Security Agency. And he offered me a job as an economist. And eventually I became chief economist, but well, actually it didn't take very long. But my job was an economic hitman.
Were you surprised about all of that, like the chain of events and how fast and quick it seemed like this moved?
Yes, I was very surprised, first of all, that the NSA accepted me, because under a lie detector test, I had to confess to the fact that I didn't believe in the Vietnam War. And they asked me if I'd ever had a run with police. And in fact, while I was in college, at a previous college, I'd gotten involved in a fight, a barroom fight. A friend of mine who was Iranian had pulled a knife and cut the guy's throat who I was fighting with. Just cut his cheek. Not quite the opposite of cutting his throat, cut his cheek. Uh, and uh, And then we rushed out through a bathroom window, jumped down into a river, and got out of there. And this guy, whose name was Farhad, this Iranian fellow, was very, very knowledgeable of these things. He'd been a professional soccer player. He was a street fighter. And the next morning, the police dragged me into their office and interrogated me and asked me if the guy had pulled a knife and Farhad. And I said, no, I totally lied to the police. And I had to admit this under oath. Yeah, I got in trouble with the police. I lied to them. And so I thought, you know, I'm doomed. There are a number of other things, but those are two big ones. And as it turned out, the NSA knew we at that point that we were losing the war in Vietnam. They actually took it as smart of me not to want to go. And they were really impressed with the fact I lied to police and had the courage to do that and would stand up to a friend. And as it turned out, Farhad's father was a general in the Shah's army, very close to the Shah, and worked with the CIA. So it was these things I thought were negatives were very positives.
Right. Yeah. That is interesting. Okay. So you become the VP or the economist at this corporation here, and then you become the economic hitman. What exactly then did you do?
Yeah, well, I had a very good staff, too, up to 50 people. And my job was to basically identify countries that had resources our corporations wanted, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. But the money wasn't used to help the country so much as to hire U.S. corporations to build big infrastructure projects in the country, things like hydroelectric dams, power systems, highways, ports, airports, things that benefited a few wealthy families in the country that owned all the big industries. And usually this was the president and his cronies and friends, and they owned the commercial establishments. They benefited tremendously from these big infrastructure projects. Plus, we had all kinds of little, you know, what you might call bribes, although for the most part, they were legal, what we did, arranging for their kids to come to school in the United States, giving them huge scholarships, doing things like that were legal, but were really bribes. And our corporations, of course, that built these projects made a lot of money, big profits off of them. And the company was left holding a huge debt that it couldn't repay. And the collateral on the debt was the resource that we coveted, like oil or whatever it happened to be. And so at some point we'd go in, usually under the guise of the International Monetary System, the IMF, and say, hey, you know, since you can't pay your debts, give us a pound of flesh. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies without environmental or social regulations. Privatize your public sector businesses like water and sewage systems and electric utilities and sell them to our investors cheap, and let us build a military base on your soil and vote with us on the next UN vote against Cuba or China or whatever. So I was creating what we now call a death economy and a global empire. Really, it's a corporate empire as much as an American empire, very, very much supported by the United States infrastructure.
You just said it was a death economy, a corporate economy, but it seemed like it was supported by the government, the IMF and the World Bank. How is that working together? Was it like, it's almost like a bunch of, I think of Russian oligarchs in the former Soviet Union. That's how they got their hands on the assets. Was it similar to that, if you would?
Well, yeah, I think it was more subtle than that when I was doing this. I think it's become that increasingly. And I believe that the current administration, the Trump administration, has really modeled that approach after Putin. It's one of the reasons there's such a close tie between the two. But in my day, it was a little more subtle, I think, in that it was really done because so many of the heads in government, heads of agencies, people in top positions came out of these corporations. So, you know, so the person charged with the responsibility of regulating oil companies had been an oil executive. and later would go back into the oil business. So go figure, you know, what's his benefits here? And so I you know, for me, I knew that my job was to try to give these, convince these countries to take as big a loan as possible. And I had guys, I was a lousy economist, quite frankly. But I was a pretty good con artist. And I could write reports really well as a good writer and a good talker. And my job was to convince, to go in and identify what sector of the economy. So let me start over. So let's say the World Bank decides it wants to give some huge amount of money to Ecuador, where I'd been a Peace Corps volunteer. And it was one of the countries where I ended up working. And because Ecuador has a lot of oil, they want Ecuador to become indebted to them. And so I know that the World Bank wants to give, they've earmarked Ecuador for a large loan, which I thought was a gift in those days. I thought what I was doing was the right thing, because I would then go in and figure out, well, what's the best thing to invest this money in that'll help the GDP growth? Is it electric power system? Is it a port system, a highway system? What is the best thing? And once I determined that, I would then convince the president or his minister of finance, the whole group of people, to take these loans and to sign off. And then the World Bank makes the loan, but it doesn't actually go to the country. It's transferred from World Bank to a bank in, let's say, San Francisco for Bechtel Corporation, or Houston for Brown & Root, or Boston for Stone & Webster, wherever the company that gets the contract. And, you know, for most of the time I had that job, which was for 10 years, for at least 7 of those years, I thought I was doing the right thing, because statistically you can show that when you go to a poor country and invest these huge sums of money in infrastructure, the GDP grows. And it does, and you can show that. And the real measure was GDP per capita. That increases, which makes it look like everybody in the country per capita. That's each person. They're all getting better. But the truth of the matter is GDP really measures how well the very rich are doing and the big corporations. GDP per capita does not measure prosperity for the normal citizen at all. It sounds, it's a misconception. It's a lie. But I believe that lie because I've been taught in business school. It's what the World Bank's, we're helping the people by per capita incomes growing. And it wasn't until after about 7 years or so that I was in this job that I began to understand the true meaning of GDP and GDP per capita.
So when you give this loan to Ecuador, hypothetically, and then would the money be invested in the infrastructure, or would it be in the pocket of the elite over there? Or there had to be some outcome, if you get a tangible outcome that you could see.
Yeah, we built these projects. We built the hydro dams and transmission systems and distribution systems for electricity. That was one of the primary things that we did.
Right.
We're well built, I have to say. Now, the Chinese have a very similar model these days, and I've seen some pretty poor construction on their part. But we built these systems. And companies that built them, Bechtel, Halliburton, Brown & Root, Stone & Webster, made big profits off them. Because the contracts were set up, they would make big profits off them. And, you know, as I said, the people who in the country, the few families, that most of these countries are run by a few families, and they prosper because they own the big industries. They own the banks and the commercial establishments that benefit from having better and more stable electricity, more reliable and growing electricity, and highways and ports and all of those sorts of things. So yes, if the projects were built, the money went in, but you know, a large part of it, I don't know, a percentage of the money that went in also resulted in profits for the corporations built, big profits. And the people in the country, not the wealthy families didn't just benefit from the infrastructure, but also, as I mentioned before, we would make sure that they got a lot of perks out of the deal. So, for example, we would tell the president of the country, listen, I know your sister owns the John Deere franchise. We're gonna rent a lot of John Deere equipment. And, you know, we're going to let us for it to be discounted. We're going to do the opposite. You don't say it like this, but you set up a contract so that you're paying $2 million for equipment that's only worth $1 million. Who gets the $1 million? And the sister's company gets it, but, you know, it's probably a lot of it's going to the president. That's not our business. How he and his sister resolve this issue, we don't want to know. But what we do know is that we're paying more than we should for a lot of things. And there's nothing illegal about it. If anybody ever questioned it, which they never did, but if they did, we just, maybe somebody gets fired for striking a bad deal, but it's not illegal.
Got it. So what made it so such a disadvantage one-sided agreement to the Ecuadors of the world, meaning like, so you convinced the Ecuador president or whoever to take this loan? Was it the terms in the agreement just make it impossible for Ecuador, the Ecuadors of the world, to pay it back? Was it too high of an interest rate? Or, yeah, what?
Yeah, it's as though, you know, you won't go to the bank, you want to buy a house. And you go to the bank and you figure that you can buy a house for $300,000, let's say, because you've looked at all the information about how much money you make and what percentage of that should go to buy your house, and it comes out to be $300,000. You go to the bank, and the banker says, well, actually, we think you can afford a $500,000 house. And that's happened. And you buy the $500,000 house. You trust your banker, but you can't make the payments. And, you know, this is some of what happened back in around the year before 2008, before the crash that happened. And the banks convince you to take a bigger loan than you can. And then they foreclose on you and they resell the house. And so it's kind of that same deal where our job was to make sure that these countries took a bigger loan than they could repay, and to convince, you know, my job was to convince the president, oh yeah, this is a good deal for you guys. And of course, in a way, the presidents and ministers of state wanted to hear this because they were going to make a lot of money off of it. And yeah, maybe it bankrupt their country, but by then their term would be up. They would no longer be president. They would probably move to Miami or Rio de Janeiro,
right.
Europe, and so forth. So they get wealthy. Our corporations get wealthy. Oh, and of course, the other side of it is that they and we knew that if they didn't accept these deals, the people we call jackals would go in. And these are usually retired CIA assets or special forces guys who will overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. And would be
about that.
Yeah, the United States has a long history of that.
Yeah, I want to work that out. So you would say, okay, Mr. President, and I don't want to pick on Ecuador here, and let's say it's Argentina, or let's say it's someplace in Southeast Asia, Vietnam or Cambodia. You would say, Mr. President, okay, you don't want the loan? Well, I'm bringing in my friends here. And then 6 months later, 12 months later, that guy was either dead or he was out of power. Is that correct?
Right. It made my job easy. Basically, I could, you know, say to a president, here, in this hand, I've got a few billion dollars for you and your family. Or if you don't want to take that, in this hand, I got a gun. And I didn't carry a gun. But
yeah,
the president knew what had happened to Allende in Chile and Arbenz in Guatemala and Mossadegh in Iran and Lumumba in the Congo and Ziem in Vietnam, and on and on. The list is extensive, the things that the United States has actually admitted to. And these presidents all know this. And I don't really have to say very much about this. They understand.
Yeah, you had all the leverage.
Yeah, yeah. Tremendous leverage. I had both the carrot and the stick.
Yeah. Fascinating. So fast forward this. Well, I want to talk about China, but I want to pin this aside because I want to ask another question first, because it seems like you alluded to that China's doing this right now, especially I think of like Africa. I think of all these investments they're doing in Africa, which is very, very rich in natural resources. So I find that interesting. I want you to work that out with me. But before that, the whole idea of the World Bank and the IMF, tell me about that. Who's controlling that? I mean, that's who's giving these loans here. Can you work that out for me?
Yeah, well, the World Bank, you know, the United States is the biggest investor. About, that's almost three times as much as the next biggest investor. And the president of the United States gets to nominate and basically choose the president of the World Bank. We control the World Bank in the same way that China controls the BRICS banks, even though there's many other countries involved in both cases. And you've got to understand, too, that most of the people who are in high positions in these banks have been ministers of state, finance ministers, or even presidents of other countries. And they all come in and they're part of the system. And I don't want to vilify all these people that work. There's a lot of really good people who work for the World Bank and these other organizations, and most of them don't understand the situation, just like I didn't. You know, they've gone to business school, whatever, and they've been told that this is the right thing to do, and they believe it for the most part, until they read my book, or talk to somebody else who knows. And most of them, that never happens. And once it does happen, like for me, once I realized that what I was doing was basically lying to myself and lying to the world, I didn't want to admit it, Andy. I'm making a lot of money. I come from a pretty poor teacher's family in rural New Hampshire. You know, we weren't impoverished, but we never had much money. And now suddenly I'm flying first class around the world. I'm wining and dining with presidents. I'm staying in the best hotels and eating at the best restaurants. Yeah, and making a damn good salary. So you get stuck in the system. You don't want to believe. Once you start to see the light, you don't want to see what light it
is. Yeah. You know, the life on what you were doing.
Yeah.
No, I, it's kind of like, and I'm just, again, I'm working through this myself. It's kind of like, I think that's very human nature with all of, in all of us. And I think it's like almost similar to like living in a cult. You just, you maybe you question it. You, okay, I don't believe this, but all my friends are, and my people are here, if you would.
Yeah. So. And there's a tremendous system out there to convince you. So several times once I understood what I was doing, I decided to quit, and I would tell my boss I was going to quit, and he'd immediately send me up to personnel, which is now human relations. And the guy up there was very, very skillful. And the head of that department, and he'd say, look, you know, like, my God, you've been made the youngest partner in the firm. Or he'd say, we're going to make you the youngest partner in the firm, which they did in this 100-year history. You're on a roll, man. You know, you've got it made. People would give their right arm to have your job. And what you're doing is a really good thing. I mean, you know, just look at the statistics. We're helping all these countries. We brought all these students. We've given scholarships to all these students. And we would brag about this, incidentally, to the Boston Globe. We were a Boston-based company. And we could get kids, you know, presidents' sons and daughters into many of these great schools in Boston. We had great connections with them and pay for scholarships. And so, you know, the guy in personnel would say, you know, like, look what you're doing. You know, why would you even consider quitting? And I'd say, yeah, well, maybe it would be a dumb thing to do after all. I would stay on again for a while. And finally, a real moment of an epiphany, a real moment of enlightenment when I decided I couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, tell me about China here again. It seems like they have their own systems doing the similar thing, or they're doing what we're doing now. I don't really know. Or tell me what they're doing, especially specifically with Africa. And I bring up Africa just because I have a background in natural resources, and it's so rich with natural resources. And it seems like
richest country in the richest continent in the world.
Yes.
Why is poorest, and the poorest people. So I taught at an MBA program in Shanghai a few years back, and these were all Chinese students, mostly Chinese students who'd been handpicked to be the future leaders of China. And I realized as soon as I started lecturing there, that what they wanted to know was what I'd done that was successful and what I'd done that was not successful, so they could learn from my mistakes and my successes. And, you know, their economic hitmen have done a bang up job around the world. They've done an amazing job. They've got an incredible story to tell, which we can get into if you want. But, you know, as an example, take a look at this map. And it's like people want to get this map. I have a newsletter that you can subscribe to on my website, and you can just go in and look past blogs. And the most recent blog has this map. But it shows at the top that 80% of the nations in the world, the number one trading partner was the United States in the year 2000. And in the year 2020, it was China. And you can look at Africa, look at Latin America, look at Africa. I mean, the United States isn't number one in any country.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that happened in 20 years. And in the last 5 years, it's gotten even more pronounced, but the statistics aren't reliable at this point. These are statistics from the IMF itself. China's economic hitmen have really done a bang up job. At the same time, the United States has fallen flat. Oh, during those 20 years, we were investing huge amounts of resources, money, and energy in Afghanistan and Iraq and other places like in the Middle East, but primarily those two. China wasn't doing that. They were going into Africa and Latin America and the rest of the world, including Europe. And we were ignoring most of the rest of the world. And of course, now it's going to be worse. I'm convinced, because the United States is becoming more and more nationalistic and dropping out of doing these things, USAID, et cetera. So China has an incredible history of being able to take advantage of our mistakes and our neglect of other parts of the world, or us pissing off the other parts of the world. We have over 170 military bases in more than 100 countries. Most of those countries don't want, the people in those countries don't want the military bases. Right. China very seldom does that. They built a couple of military bases in Africa, but nothing to as significant as what we've done. We've pissed off a lot of people who will turn to China instead. And China has an incredible story to tell. I don't want to dominate this conversation, Andy.
Please, at the edge of my seat.
China, you know, so you're the president of one of these countries that you mentioned, Asia, Africa, Latin America, and China's economic hitmen come in and they say, hey, just look at the numbers. We in China, we had 10% average economic growth for 30 years. Nobody else has ever done anything like that. We brought 900 million people out of dire poverty. That's more than twice the population of the United States. Meanwhile, the real wage, the minimum federal wage in the United States hasn't increased since the early 70s. People are doing a lot worse. The United States middle class has shrunk from 60% to 50%. Mr. President, which system do you want? You don't have to take our government system. You don't have to become communist or whatever the heck we are, combination of capitalism and communism. You can do whatever you want with your system. We won't interfere with that at all. Again, unlike the United States, we won't try to, to control your politics or your government. We just want to give you this loan. and make your oil or lithium today, cobalt, the rare minerals that are used in high tech, we'll just use those as collateral. So, so basically, Andy, it's the same goal, it's the same game, but they have a remarkable story to tell. And they also have a very good sense for taking advantage of our missteps around the world.
So my question would go to, what's their leverage? Is it just, why wouldn't you do business with them? Is that really,
yeah,
makes so much sense? Or
yeah, they offer these same loans that we offer, and their companies will do the construction instead of ours, and they won't interfere with government planning, and they have this amazing model, and they won't build military bases on your soil. Oh, and incidentally, you know, if the United States comes in here, Mr. President, they're going to offer you most favored nation contracts. So you'll have this very good trading agreement with the United States, but that'll exclude most everybody else. We don't do that. We in China, we're going to make you part of the new Silk Road. We're going to build ports for you that, so if you in Peru, your country in Peru, the United States is going to tell you, you'll have most favored nation with the United States. Don't worry about in other countries. Well, we tell you, we're going to make it possible for you to, you know, have tremendous commerce with all of Latin America and Asia and Africa and Europe. Everybody, we're going to build these ports. We're going to build these trains. We're going to build these transportation systems that allow you to be part of the new Silk Road, which is a huge selling point. And, you know, it's all true, Andy, at the basis is, you know, the same, let's steal the resources. We're going to get the resources. We're going to get the oil, or we're going to get the lithium, or whatever it is that they want to get. And in some cases, it's just big markets. And in the case of Africa, it's also dominating a continent that has the lowest age, you know, average age. I think it's 19 years old. It was their average age throughout the continent. And China is dealing with a big problem of a growingly old population. They need young people to support their growing population in China. They're not going to get it in China, and they know this. So let's go out to Africa and get those young people to support our social programs for the future.
Got it. So let's say you're a president of an African or Latin American country, and you tell China, okay, I can't pay the loan. What is China going to come and seize the natural resources or the property or whatever? I mean, I don't really see them coming and invading. Maybe they would. I mean, yeah.
They have no history of invading or overthrowing or separating leaders, which is another thing that works to their advantage. But they have contracts with the country that says if you can't pay your loan, no problem. Your oil or your lithium or whatever is your collateral. We'll take that just like the bank would do for you if you can't, you know, pay your loan on your house. The collateral in that case is the house, and they get the house. In this case, it's whatever it is. It's the resource that's applicable to a particular country, which is pretty much the same tool we used before that to get countries to accept these deals. We would also be known that the Japanese were standing behind us. And China doesn't do that. That's another advantage they have, is they don't make those kind of threats. And they don't have a history of participating in coups or assassinations. Except in Taiwan and Hong Kong and some of the areas that border India. And when I talk to them about that, and I point out to them they say, well, they used to say, well, look at what you did with Mexico. You took half of Mexico now. And I just, my most recent book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, is a trilogy. And the most recent book, very, very surprisingly, which is very critical of China, just came out in China, is now a bestseller in China, which really surprises. We thought it would be censored because it's quite critical of China. But where was I going with this? But so when I talk, and I've spent a lot of time, I've just been on the China news agency, I do doing a lot of interviews in China. And if you bring up Taiwan and Hong Kong and those issues, they'll say, well, you're threatening to invade Panama. You know, you're threatening to take over Canada and Greenland. Right. You know, so it's, you know, it's, we all have these different stories. In the United States, we paint some bleak pictures of China, and China's able to paint some bleak pictures of us. All of those bleak pictures have some truth behind them.
Yeah.
And then, so, a lot of hyperbole.
Yeah.
Right.
So game this out for me. Where does this end with the U.S. and China on this collision course then for natural resources in Africa or Latin America? Or have they won? Have they won already?
They've won. They're winning. The United States is on the decline, and China's on the incline. And I think, I try to stay very apolitical in all of this, but I am concerned that what the United States is now doing, and this current administration, is going to make it that much easier for China. For one thing, that the tariffs that we're imposing will make American-made goods cheaper in the United States vis-a-vis those of China, vis-a-vis them. But in the rest of the world, American products, things made in the United States, will become much more expensive vis-a-vis what China makes. So China is actually going to benefit from these tariffs, and in terms of selling to the rest of the world. So I think we're, you know, this decline is accelerating. So where does this take us? Well, to me, the most important thing, and when I lecture in China, when I have interviews in China, I point this out, that the United States and China combined produce about almost half of the world's GDP and almost half the world's pollution. We both are promoting what's called a death economy, an economic system that's based on maximizing short-term profits and materialistic consumption. And it's polluting and consuming itself toward self-destruction. There's no question about it. You know, most of the major crises in the world, the problems that were climate change, income inequality, species extinction, environmental destruction, those are problems, but they're not the problem. They're all symptoms of this death economy. And both these countries are promoting a death economy. So for me, the hope is to get these countries to understand that we have to create a life economy, an economic system that's based on long-term maximization benefits and paying people to clean up pollution, to corral all the plastic that's floating around in the oceans and recycle it, to regenerate destroyed environments. I mean, I'm not talking about making people suffer and have jobs. I'm talking about giving people jobs and creating all kinds of new technologies. You know, we have wind and solar, but it's just the beginning of the possibilities of producing energy from air and water. And, you know, we're in a fast track of being able to create a completely new economic system, and AI can help us in that process. And I was encouraged. I'm encouraged by young people everywhere who understand this. And in China, you know, the people I was teaching at this MBA program said, you know, we created an economic miracle of, you know, the things I described, but it came at a horrible, horrible price, environmentally and socially. And we know we can create a miracle. And so we suffered. We young people suffered through terrible pollution. We don't want our kids to go through that. Your young people don't even understand what it's like to live with this horrible pollution that we've had to suffer through. So we're going to create a miracle environmentally and socially. That's what these students at the MBA program told me. And you know, I think they believed it. Will they do it? I don't know. And I hear young people in the States saying similar things. And that's also, in both countries, there's a fear of AI on the part of young people, like what jobs are going to be available. To, you know, like I have a grandson who always thought he wanted to be a lawyer, and now he's believing that a lot of that profession is to be taken out by not all of it. And So now he's thinking about going into computer sciences or something, you know, along those lines. But he also wants to do it to make the world a better place so he can have children and grandchildren that'll thank him for the jobs that he's done. And I hear that all over the world. So that gives me hope that we've got a generation that's coming along that's going to move in that direction.
Excellent. I think that's a great place to end, ending on hope. John, if people want to know more about your works, I will link to everything in the show notes, both on the YouTube broadcast as well as the Apple and Spotify. But how do they find you? How do they read your books?
The best place to go is johnperkins.org. All that information is there. You know, my books are for sale everywhere. They can find it there. I've got a new book coming out within the next month or two. And if you sign up for my newsletter on that website, you put your email address in a little box. My newsletter is fairly brief and it comes out just once a month. The next one, well, people will get the first chapter of my book free. And then for $12, I think it is, it's only digital. Although I've published with Penguin and Random House and Caracol and all the big ones, this one I'm doing as a self-published book because I want people to be able to get it inexpensively and only digitally, and it probably will be audio also. So if you sign up for my newsletter, you'll get the first chapter free, and then you can decide whether you want to get the rest of it or not for a pretty reasonable price. So yeah, johnperkins.org, and everything else is there.
I'll put everything in the show notes. And John, I have not yet signed up for your newsletter, but I will. So I want to thank you so much for your time. And just to all my listeners and viewers, that's how I found John. I found him on, actually just listened to him on another podcast and for years ago. And then I stumbled upon your site and I was like, I wonder if this guy would talk to me. And you've been incredibly gracious. So thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you for what you do, Andy. And this is all about getting the word out. I think all your listeners should feel blessed to be alive at this point, this time in history. I feel blessed that, yes, we're facing big crises, big challenges, and tremendous opportunities. We are living at a time when we're redefining what it means to be humans. We have to redefine what it means to be successful human beings, being human on this planet. You know, we're going through an amazing consciousness change. We're understanding the systems we've created did magnificent things for us, but they've come to that point where they have to evolve and change.
Yeah.
And evolve. It's an evolutionary process. And we're so lucky to be alive at this time. And I really encourage readers to feel that. In my books, the most recent books, I talk about, you know, what each of us can do individually to do what we most want to do in the world and do it in a way that creates a better world for future generations.
John Perkins, thanks for leading the charge. Really do appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Andy. Thanks for all you do. Thanks for keep spreading the word.
Will do.